That's all he did. And as I say, I think that's the only time he ever supported that.
But there's a difference between you and him, not in philosophy, but in roles, and that is his being a political role. I'm really trying to understand. I'll talk to him later, but could he not perceive it as being in the interest of the Democratic Party for him to support Wallace because of what Wallace can contribute to party success in the South?
I think Vance does perceive his as a political role, but he's not willing to pay the price of supporting Wallace to continue that political role. I don't think that his personal integrity and background would allow him to do that. I just don't think it's possible. Now, I may be wrong. We'll know this fairly soon. We'll know this within a year. We'll know it specifically. We'll probably know it after May. We won't know it for certain until next January, but we probably will know it after May.
So next January is what?
That's when they reorganize the Democratic Committee.
So we can discuss that when I get to Alabama.
Yeah, they reorganize the committee. The organization of the Democratic Party in Alabama is a very complex thing.
What's your reaction to Neil Pierce's thesis that Frank Johnson has had more impact on politics in Alabama in the broad sense than George Wallace has?
I'd say that Frank Johnson's had more impact on social change in Alabama than George Wallace has. Now, I don't know, you know, you get blurred definitions when you talk about sociology as opposed to politics. But I can tick off the things that Frank Johnson has done. His achievements have been a thorough desegregation of the school system. Now, he's not alone in this. There's another federal judge, too, Reeves, who being on the Court of Appeals, is not on the front line like Wallace, like Johnson, but is a very strong man in the background and in many ways influences Johnson very heavily in his decision.
Both of them have an appointment.
No, Reeves goes back to Truman. Mm-hmm. Reeves is the great man of the judiciary. He's in the whole South, in my thinking. I'm not trying to diminish Johnson for that, because Johnson himself admits that he owes, you know, enormous debts to Richard Reeves. But together, they have desegregated the school systems in Alabama. They are on three-judge panels, which have done all these things. They've desegregated the state bureaucracy in Alabama, in employment and what have you. Johnson alone has totally remade the mental health, the treatment of the mentally ill in Alabama, totally restructured that. He and Reeves together have reapportioned that legislature as no other two judges have done. It's not generally known, but the critical reapportionment case came up out of Alabama. It was a Reeves-Johnson decision. The Baker versus Carr decision in Tennessee, which is regarded as the reapportionment decision, you know, that wasn't really it. All the court said in Baker versus Carr was that this is an area in which the courts have a legitimate, there is a justiciable issue. But it was an Alabama case, Reynolds versus Sims, which was the one man, one vote case. And that was Reeves and Johnson that wrote that. And they've even extended it beyond one man, one vote now, with this new reapportionment we've got. So they've been very much.
What do you mean by they've extended it beyond?
Well, it gets complicated because the new legislature that they've structured now tends to obliterate county lines and things like that. It comes up with it says that the apportionment must be so precise that county lines have to be ignored if necessary to get proper balances. And it's the first step toward the destruction of counties as political entities in Alabama.
That's been upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Been upheld, right. And it goes into effect as of this year's elections.
And that could well set a precedent for the entire South.
You could set a precedent for the country. They've sort of picked at this issue in other states. I think Indiana has and what have you, but the most massive and drastic change has occurred in Alabama.
Who actually drew up the plan, mechanically?
A statistician from New York using the census districts. He constructed legislative districts by building them out of census blocks, and he ignored county lines in doing it. Now, he tried to maintain county lines wherever possible, just for politics, you know, in the interest of politics, but it was drawn up by a computer is what it was done. And it's created chaos. And we're going to have a bad session of the legislature next time around as they feel their way around. But as they become adjusted, we're going to have one of the best legislatures in the country.
What do you think it will eventually mean as far as counties are concerned, county units of government?
It changes so totally the relationship between the legislature and the county, because you see, in times past, under the legislative courtesy rule, the county legislator, nothing he submitted was challenged. He got through local bills without any challenge at all up there. So there was a hand-in-glove working relationship between the county bureaucracy and your state legislators. If the county commissioner or the probate judge wanted a raise, he had to go to the state legislator, who took it to the legislature and got it very easily. So they had to work together very closely that way. Well, with this obliteration of the county lines, you don't know who to go to get this change made. What it's going to mean is ultimately the legislature is probably going to adopt a larger measure of home rule. But you've got Barber County, for instance, is divided among four different legislative districts. Now, who are they going to go to when they need a raise? They don't have a legislator any longer. So it's having a profound impact. It's also going to elect a lot of blacks. It'll elect a lot of people representing poor districts, and it'll elect a lot of Republicans, all of which we've never had in the legislature.
What are the other major changes that, you know, effect of Frank Johnson?
His effect has been so profound that it's... reapportionment and race, of course, are the big ones. The mental health cases are tremendously significant, and through a whole wide range of areas, Johnson has extended procedural due process of law in little ways that you wouldn't notice. If a school principal kicks somebody out because boys wear long hair, they've had cases in Frank Johnson's court, and he says, did you give him due process of law? Did you have a written rule that he couldn't wear his hair this way and that sort of thing? You've had it come up in the prison system where an inmate would be put into isolation for some in-prison infraction, and they'll come into court, and Johnson will look into the case. Did you give him due process of law? Did you allow him a hearing on this? Did you have the rules clearly posted that he was violating, and this sort of thing? So his very tenacious insistence on the application of procedural due process has been very significant. It's cleaned up the justice of the bureaucratic system. In employment, he's had a tremendous effect, too. As far as I know, he's the only judge in the country that has ordered specific quotas for hiring. In the state trooper case, he held first that there was discrimination, a clear pattern of discrimination against blacks. Out of 800 troopers, we had no blacks, so that wasn't too hard to prove. And then he ordered the state to hire, as they hired new troopers, to hire one black for every white until the state trooper force reached 25% black, which is the state's population of black. Now, that's the only ruling in the country that's come like that. He hasn't applied that so rigidly in other areas, but the implication is that it would apply to every other agency of government as well. There's no reason why it shouldn't.
How does Wallace react to him?
He reacts violently to it.
Not only to that.
Personally to Johnson.
Yeah.
Well,
go ahead and finish what you were saying.
Well, that does finish what I was saying. Wallace reacts violently to it, and as a matter of fact, he's right now under the shadow of a contempt of court citation for refusing to carry out the state trooper decision. It's not going to come to a contempt. For God's sakes, don't say this, because Johnson told me this personally at some Christmas party where I ran into him. He said he's not interested in citing Wallace for contempt. All he's interested in doing is seeing his order carried out. Johnson is acutely aware of never entering an order that he's not certain can be carried out. He's very aware of that. But to get back to the personal relationships of Wallace and Johnson, well, it goes back to college when they the legend has overstated their friendship. They were on friendly terms, but they were not close friends. They were college classmates and that sort of thing. As they got out, they went their separate ways. Johnson was Republican. Wallace was a populist Democrat and so on. Their paths didn't cross until around 1958 when Johnson was a federal judge and Wallace was a state judge. And Wallace, getting ready to run for governor, made this gesture of defiance toward the Civil Rights Commission, refused to give him the voting records. Well, the upshot of it was that he created so much chaos and so much publicity and what have you that Johnson ordered him in court on a contempt proceeding. Contempt is a legally mumbo-jumbo type area where your initial order is an order to appear before this court to show cause why you should not be cited for contempt, you know, piling negatives on top of negatives and so on. So, in any case, Wallace got a hell of a lot of mileage out of it from a political standpoint. And the election was over. He lost the election. That was in 58. The election was over when they finally got around to resolving the contempt business against him. So Johnson called him into court, and Wallace appeared in Johnson's court, the only time he has ever been in Frank Johnson's courtroom, although he's been sued in Johnson's courtroom a million times. Wallace appeared, and as far as I know, he didn't say anything. This was in January of 59, if I'm not mistaken. He appeared in court and didn't say anything, and Johnson read an order from the bench in which he said that the court has found that essentially this has been an attempt to use this court for political purposes, but this court will not be bowed to political whirlwinds and things like that. He made a mistake, really, in going that far, and I think he recognized this. Oh, incidentally, and I've got this fairly well documented in New South, Wallace privately tried to negotiate with Johnson on the basis of their old friendship. This was before they were at such their enmity had solidified and what have you. And quite specifically asked Johnson, says, I want you to help me get elected governor. Will you give me a 20-day sentence in jail or a heavy fine or something like that? And Johnson wouldn't make any commitments on it. He said, you just have to take your chances. And Wallace certainly wasn't going to take any chance on going to jail for a year, maybe 20 days, but not a year. Well, this came to nothing. This was a midnight visit. It's like I say, I've got it written up pretty well. But in any case, in reading this order, Johnson came to the conclusion that in spite of his gesture of defiance, Wallace in covert ways and through subterfuge had cooperated with the agencies and had turned over the records to them. So there was no contempt, and he dismissed the contempt proceeding on that basis. So he was calling Wallace a hypocrite in public. Well, 4 years later, when Wallace ran for governor again, one of the lesser running candidates who was Wallace was certainly one of the forefront candidates, but one of these backfield candidates and what have you, way down the end of the track, thought he could get a little mileage out of this by pointing out the fact that Frank Johnson had said that Wallace was a hypocrite, that he really wasn't a fighter at all. He knuckled under when the chips were down. Well, this infuriated Wallace, and in every speech that he made from there on out, he says, anybody that says that I cooperated with the federal agents is a scalawagon, carpet-bagging, integrating liar. And that's what he was calling Frank Johnson throughout his campaign. And it was very effective, and he won the campaign. He'd get great cheers when he'd call Johnson this scalawagon, integrating, carpet-bagging liar. He never was as abusive, never quite so abusive after that. Although he could pour scorn on the federal courts, and he'd call special sessions of the legislature for no purpose other than just passing resolutions denouncing the federal courts. And he has said on many occasions in a very temperate sort of way, in sort of conversations, and not in an acrimonious way at all, but almost an offhanded way, he'd say, the governor in this state has no power. The federal judge is the only one that's got any power in this state. And I think he probably believes that. There is a very fundamental, legitimate ideological difference between the men.
Does it spill over into personal enmity?
Oh, I just cannot conceive of those two men sitting down in the same room together. Their hostility toward one another. Johnson is very guarded about his. My guess is that you've got something as close to a hatred for two people as you could possibly have between those two men. Probably the hatred is greater on Johnson's part than it is on Wallace's, for the simple reason that Johnson is in a position where he can't respond. He has to take all that abuse. And I'd certainly feel damned aggrieved myself if someone called me a scalawagon liar and I couldn't say anything about it. But at the same time, there is a great measure of truth in what Wallace says about the federal judge has got all the power. There's one order pending right now. And I think Johnson made a mistake in doing this. I really wouldn't want to be quoted on saying this, but I think he made a mistake on it anyway. In one of his mental health cases, in which he's laid down very specific ratios of how many... laid down very specific ratios on how many psychiatrists the state's got to employ, how many nurses and teachers and what have you in the mental institutions. And in there, he makes a somewhat circumspect threat, saying that if it comes to this, or this court is reserving judgment on the question of whether or not it can judicially divert funds, say from the highway department to the mental health department, in order to carry out this order. Well, if that decision is carried out, that'll be as fundamental a decision as Marbury against Madison.
Well, what's his constitutional basis?
I don't think he has any.
What's his constitutional basis for the even mandating the number of psychiatrists?
Oh, well, now that gets into it. Let's walk on back. Very sound ground on that. He first says this. If you take away a man's liberty by committing
Is it due process?
Due process.
Okay.
Basically what it is, yeah. There's just not another federal judge in the country that's come to know anywhere close to being as active as he has. He's been pretty active in civil liberties, too. For instance, this was one point in which I disagreed with him, really. They had a little student fund over at Auburn, I don't remember the exact circumstances of it, but somehow or another, the students wanted to invite William Sloan Coffin, you know, who he is, the Yale chaplain, very controversial guy, and so on. The university authorities turned it down, this is some sort of student speakers fund. It had a very specific amount of money, something like $35,000-$50,000 in it, to get speakers down there, 6 or 8 or 10 speakers a year. And they took the case in federal court, and Johnson ordered the university to let Coffin speak, which was fine up to that point, but he also ordered him to pay him the fee, you see, to pay his expenses and pay his honorarium down there and so on. Well, now, you see, what the judge did at that point was get into the business of choosing specific speakers when you've got a limited number of speakers. Let's say you've got 6 speakers that you can get for that amount of money. Well, to me, it stands to reason that the university has got to have some sort of say-so over that. A matter of simply having him come on campus and speak, if some students invited him down there at their own cost and what have you, and for him to come on the campus and speak, that's one thing, but to require the university to pay him struck me as being a little bit far out. But anyway, he's been in a lot of rulings like that as well. Let's see, he's been pretty much in the forefront on women's rights. one case where he and Judge Reeves dissented. They were part of one of the very few. There's a woman Air Force officer that sued the Air Force for the same type of benefits that male officers get for their wives, housing benefits and medical benefits and things like this, which had been denied to female officers. And it struck me as being a pretty open and shut case of discrimination, and Johnson held that the 14th Amendment forbade this sort of thing. The Air Force had to give her exactly what they gave male officers, which stood to reason to me. And Reeves came to some sort of tortured reasoning and in the thing, he and the other judge in the case, and held that, no, the Air Force didn't have to pay her the same fringe benefits and so on. What do they call it? It's not that, but anyway, fringe benefits is what it amounts to. And that went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court upheld Johnson in that case.
Looking back.
That's a good story, by the way. Let me tell you that. I have more than one sources independently. But when Haynesworth was first appointed, wasn't Haynesworth Nixon's first appointment to the court? Well, it was all of Johnson's friends lobbied very strongly to get him on the court. Well, John Mitchell, of course, was the man who checked out all the Supreme Court appointments. He's the one that submitted names to Nixon and made recommendations and what have you. Well, Johnson's got a strong sort of law and order record. He is that. Boy, he's not much, he's a no-nonsense man on that sort of thing. And Mitchell apparently pulled out Johnson's file up there and looked through his record of cases and everything. He says, this is exactly the man we want for the Supreme Court. They sent, I don't know whether it ever got to the White House or not, but anyway, they started, the motions of getting Johnson appointed to the Supreme Court. And So they said, well, we better check with the Republicans in Congress before we do this. And they went to the Alabama Republicans, and they said, absolutely not. And Johnson's own Republicans now put it down. So they said, okay, and apparently Mitchell considered it for a little while longer. And then he went back to the congressman and says, well, look, says, he's the man we want. We're not asking you to support him. Just if you just won't fight it, we'll get the nomination through or something to that effect. And the Republicans turned that down too. They said no, sir, that they'd resist the appointment. And they said we'll do this. We'll let you put him on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is just a way of getting him out of Alabama. Is they wanted to get him out of Alabama, but deny him the honor of the Supreme Court. You see. And so after that, Johnson's file went back into the file, and that's when they came up with Haynesworth. So he was always mentioned in all the big publications as one of the front runners, or not front runners, but one of the runners for that first vacancy. Then when the others came up, I don't think his name ever even came up for consideration again after that.
If you look back to When was Folsom governor?
Folsom, 47 through 51 and 55 through 59.
So how would you characterize his administration?
There's a book coming out on Folsom which will answer all the questions you need about him, and it'll be out early enough for yours. You can get a copy of that. But basically, Jim was as solid a populist as ever came down the road. I mean, he really was, and he was good on. He really fully appreciated the needs of the poor people in Alabama and what have you. He fully appreciated the control of the state, or not control, but the powerful influence exerted by agencies like the Farm Bureau, and he was determined to break it. And he went in and he had as fine a program as any governor ever could hope to have. But now he had a malapportioned legislature that made it impossible for him to achieve anything that he could ever hope to do. Plus the fact that he was such a wretched administrator He was a heavy drinker always. In his last administration, he was an out-and-out alcoholic. He would, they would go, you know, you'd go for 6 weeks without the governor doing anything and that sort of thing. So the two things combined, plus Jim's gentle personality and gentle nature and unwillingness to hurt anybody, he simply lacked the ruthlessness that, you know, that you have to have in politics to accomplish things. And those things pretty much made him a failure. He was a Virginia Durr best summed him up, says Jim Folsom was a flawed masterpiece. That's pretty well what he was. But he never really accomplished anything to speak of. But on the race question, he was way, way ahead on that. His Christmas message in 1949 is really one of the nicest, just simple statements about justice toward the black man that that anybody could possibly ever write. It read, this is more or less verbatim, he says, he talked about the low educational quality, the low health care that the Negro citizens got and so on. And then he says, how did he put that? Says, as long as the black man is held down, all the other poor people will be held down along with him. It's time to stop just preaching brotherhood and start practicing it, or something along that line. I can't remember the whole statement, but it's really a very beautiful statement. And that was in 49. That was 5 years before the Supreme Court ruling. And he never, of course, in 54 when he ran for re-election, he said, yeah, I'm a segregationist. I mean, I believe in segregation, but everybody believes in it. It's not an issue. And and so that was the way he dismissed it. That's all he really upset about it in the campaign. He got elected then. And when the legislature started passing all these interposition resolutions and things like that, he vetoed them. And one of them he called his pure hogwash. Said it reminds me of an old hound dog baying at the moon. And that's the kind of fellow he was. He was really just a fine man. His first administration was much better than his second, because by that time the crooks and termites and what have you and all sorts of devious characters had pretty much taken over, you know, and they ruined his reputation, blackened it so thoroughly that even then, though he damn near got reelected in 62 again, he was regarded as the man to beat. But after that, it was downhill all the way, down to nothing.
Who were the other governors? You had Patterson.
Yeah, let's see.
Who's there between all the way back. Folsom administrations?
A guy named Gordon Persons, who was sort of a moderate progressive, pretty good governor. He was governor during the Phoenix City period. That was one of his big accomplishments, was cleaning up Phoenix City. But an ordinary, run-of-the-mill, progressive governor, established a good statewide educational television network. He was in broadcasting, had a lot of interest in that. And generally ran a good shop, just he'd compare, I suppose, to John West in South Carolina. I don't know. That strikes me as being the kind of governor he was. He certainly didn't do any race baiting or anything like that.
So race really became an issue in which race?
58 was the first year it became a big issue.
It was Patterson.
Folsom, none of them had any success, whatever. I believe Bull Connor ran for governor in 54 when Folsom was elected. He was the big racist in the campaign. There were two or three racists in that 54 campaign, but Folsom won it without a runoff. Beat 14 people with a majority, a clear majority. So he really had the people with him. Every newspaper in the state was against him. You know, this is one thing that maybe would be worth trying to... Yeah, this is one of the things I came on in this chapter that I did on Southern journalism. The hostility that has always prevailed between the Southern governors and the press. And the real reason for it is that the press has been very conservative and the governors have been very liberal. That's exactly why it was. That's why the press was against Huey Long, against Jim Folsom, and... same lot of other Southern governors in that same category. And, of course, the press was against some of them, just overt race baiting like Gene Talmadge and so on. But basically it was a conservative press against populist-oriented governors, New Dealish governors, you know. But race became a big issue. I hold Jim responsible for this. It got completely out of hand in 56 when Little Rock had occurred before this. I don't remember when Little Rock occurred, but then sometime after Little Rock, very shortly after it, Authorine Lucy registered at the University of Alabama and was ordered admitted. And she was indeed admitted. And things got out of hand then. They started having bad riots on the campus and things like that. And she was in danger, there was no doubt about that. And it was Klan elements getting on the campus and that sort of thing. It wasn't really the students so much as the outsiders. And the upshot of it was that Authorine Lucy issued public statements accusing the university officials of cooperating with the Klan, with the mob that was trying to drive her off the campus, and they expelled her for that. And there was no truth in what she said. There was no way to prove it because it wasn't true. And they expelled her on that ground, and that ended it there. But now, if Jim had been on his toes, he could have kept order at the university. He could have kept those people off the campus, and all he'd have had to do was say that there ain't going to be no riots on that campus, and I'm going to have a sufficient number of state police up there to prevent it. I don't like this any more than anybody else, but we're not going to have that university destroyed. Well, if they had integrated the university at that time, you see, that would have been over then. It would have been the break. And all the other wouldn't have, it would have come slowly and gradually after that. But you see, the whites won that victory. And when they did, it just, solidified their resolve to keep the state schools segregated. And John Patterson ran primarily on a racist ticket. I'm going to keep the niggers out of the schools and that sort of thing. And he did. He kept them out. And that really introduced the era of inflamed racial politics in Alabama. He was the one who started exploiting it. And even Wallace didn't run, although he certainly made a lot of racist noises then. He got the Negro vote in 58. In a big way, he got it over Patterson. And then 4 years later, of course, was the after that was the I'll never be out niggered again, and he hadn't been.
You're convinced though he made the remark?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he made it. If he didn't make it, some of that. I never have heard anybody who said they heard him say it, but I'm pretty sure that he did. I think he denies making it. I don't know.
Yeah. How would you characterize Wallace as governor?
As governor? Now, he's bored by governor. A state senator told me a pretty good story about him one time that pretty well wraps Wallace up. He said he'd gone down there. This was before Wallace was shot, and he was a Wallace supporter. Wallace supporters are kind of interesting in the state legislature. Nobody's particularly close to Wallace, and a lot of them make fun of him, and they just deal with him and support him and what have you because he's governor and somebody's, you got to work with him after all. But this particular man was a pretty sophisticated state senator, and he said, I asked him, I said, what do you all talk about when you go down there? He said, oh, we eat Baby Ruths and cuss niggers. And I said, no, be serious. Now, tell me what you do when he's hung up on this Baby Ruth business. Tell me what you do when you go down and talk to the governor. I said, all right. I said, we went down a few days ago. We had a $110 million bond issue that we were trying to get through the legislature. And we had everybody, all of Wallace's people down there, all the legislative leaders and what have you, and we were
holding a strategy session on how to get this $110 million bond issue passed. We were talking about spending $110 million of the taxpayers' money, and I looked around, and the governor of this state was gone. And I looked all around, and there he was, standing over there by the window, looking out the window and eating a baby Ruth. So he doesn't care about things like that. So he doesn't have any, he's bored by that sort of thing. But at the same time, he's so smart. Wallace is about 10 notches above most governors I've ever known in intelligence. You know, he's got a keen memory, one which works very quickly, a mind that has an instinct for making the right decisions and so on quickly. And just by half doing it, he could make things run pretty well. But he's not what you'd call a good administrator at all, or not by a long shot. He's so totally preoccupied with politics, with running. That's all he was interested in doing. Once he got elected governor, hell, that was just a job for him to do then. The next thing he wanted was a race. And look back over his record now. I've gone through this in some stuff that I've written. He got into politics before that. He was elected to the state legislature around 52. He was elected a circuit judge in 56. No, 48 in the legislature, circuit judge in 54, ran for governor in 58. See, 2, 4, 6. In 60, he didn't run for anything, and that's supposed to be the low point in his life. He just walked around the streets of Montgomery, buttonholing people and talking to anybody that would talk to him. And then he had that really hard campaign in 62. For governor, 62 for governor, 64 for president, 66 for governor, 68 for president, 70 for governor, 72 for president, 74 for governor, 76 for president. Every other, he runs all the time.
What compulsion does he have about running? What is it?
Well, the way that I put it is that the thing that makes George Wallace run for office is the same thing that makes a drunk drink whiskey. He's just got this compulsion to do it. Now, it's got to be deeper than that. I think that he wants, as much as any man I've ever known, I think he wants to be loved by everybody. I really believe that he wants that. and his way of being loved is to, you know, is to win public office and to represent the people. He has this sort of mystical union with the people. He says, it's not George Wallace. I'm just the embodiment of what you asked me to do and this sort of thing. And he talks like that quite a lot. But, like I say...
Does he really perceive himself as being a president?
I think he does, yeah. I don't think, you know, he ever seriously considered the awesome demands on being president, for being president's own, but I think he seriously does, yeah. And he's honored it when people suggest poo-poo the idea of him being president. He thinks he's as good as anybody else to be president, is what it
amounts. What has been the effect on Wallace of the shooting? How has he responded?
Well, now that's where you get into what I was saying. It's just almost, it's so difficult to put into words. It's something that you just have to have known the man before and after to see the effect on him. He genuinely thought that he was dying when he was shot. He was prepared to die. He even has told me his thoughts about what he thought about while he was dying. You know, in his mind he was dying. What's going to happen to my family and children and that sort of thing, and so on. And he made his peace with God right there on the ambulance to the hospital, you know, when he lost consciousness after he got to the hospital. And for all intents and purposes, he went through the experience of dying. Then when he came back, it was such touch and go for so long, and he lay there and pondered death and that sort of thing. Not knowing whether he'd make it or not, and struggling to try to do it. And he has said many, many times that he thinks that God intended for him to live, and he thanks God for it, and he really means it. he came out of it with a personal religious conviction that he never had before. I don't know, maybe those nuns up at the hospital had something to do with it. He got awfully close to them, I know that, and he was in a vulnerable position during that time. And then the sickness was, you know, how many was it? 5 operations he had? Large number of operations, and these were just going into each one of them, not knowing whether he was going to live or not. And trying to come back and what have you, and trying to do the exercises, that these demanding exercises he was having to do to build up his upper body and so on. And for one point, at one point there, he seemed to be going along very well, and he was carrying on this physical therapy routine, working 4 hours, 5 hours a day on doing nothing but lifting weights and walking on the crossbars and things like that. And then all of a sudden, this prostate infection hit him, and he had to go back into the hospital. And they said, well, it's not anything serious. He's not going to be in the hospital more than 10 days. Well, he was in the hospital over a month. And he got really, really down in the dumps. All the while, he'd be beset by these terrible periods of depression. And people would tell how he'd just be reduced to, you know, sobbing for hours and that sort of thing. And he was seen in public crying, you know, weeping. And there was one story that we heard of, that it came from to us from what we regarded as pretty reliable sources, that on that last illness in Birmingham, when the prostate thing, when he stayed in the hospital for over a month, you know, that his mental condition became so serious. There's one story that he tried to jump out the window. Now, I don't know, we'll have the faintest idea whether that's true. But that it apparently became so serious that they kept 24-hour guards around him, just protect him from himself. And when I say jump out the window, crawl to the window, you know, and get up. And he could do that, I guess. but that's how bad it was. Well, then about that time, a little after that, when he seemed to be at just the very lowest point in his sickness, Harold Martin, you know who he is? He's our publisher. And he and Wallace, about like Wallace and Frank Johnson. In fact, Wallace is even more frightened of Harold Martin, because Martin has really done him in, I'm telling you. And, of course, Martin's done good work, you know. It's been most everything Martin's had. It's been damn well documented and well-based and so on. And Martin made a speech to a civic club in Montgomery, in which he called on Wallace to resign. He said he was physically incapable of running the government, and to make other arrangements, either turn the government over to the Attorney General, or if he didn't resign, in fact, to make a public statement that he was leaving public life altogether and designate some sort of committee of businessmen or something like that to run the government until his term expired. Well, this thing had, they tried every conceivable treatment that they could on Wallace to make him respond. This made him respond like none of the others did. He bounced back, he almost got up and ran out of the bed. And he's been improving ever since. And he's been damn good. And then when he made that that speech to the legislature, he opened the session of the legislature and they wheeled him in, everybody knew something was going to happen, and they constructed this box. And they wheeled him up to the box, and he grasped these things and stood up, and this was on statewide television, pulled himself up. This doesn't mean he had any use of his legs. He has no feeling below his belt. He once described to me that one of the most troubling things about the whole thing is that he has a sensation of floating, because he doesn't have any feeling where he's sitting. You see, it's as if he was suspended in air, and he also has no balance. It means that he falls around a lot and so on. He has no feeling below the belt at all, and meaning he has no control over his bowels. His sexual powers are completely gone, and that must be one hell of a damaging man to Wallace. Because you remember Folsom's great remark about him. Did you ever hear it?
I think
George don't drink, but he always was bad to fuck. And it must be a hell of a damaging thing to him. And I suspect, this is just speculation here, but I suspect the day is going to come when he's going to think his wife is running around with other men. He may already think that. That's the kind of paranoia that usually goes with this kind of injury. There's certainly been no indication that she's been doing it yet, but that's the thing that now, besides that, I mean, other ways that it's changed him, I think it has made him a genuinely more compassionate person in a very personal sense. Prior to the shooting, he was compassionate in a sort of an abstract sense. He could see a large number of people out there that had needs, you know. But for a specific individual with needs, it didn't seem to sink in so much, you know. But after this, it did. We ran a story one time, for instance, about a woman who was dying of cancer. And Wallace called her up on the telephone, you know, just to cheer her up. That was the kind of thing he did. And very quietly, without any publicity or anything, he slipped into the general appropriation bill this last session of the legislature, an appropriation which would